12 will serve a minimum of 5 years for a prolonged sadistic attack on two other young boys. They beat and sexually assaulted their victims in Edlington in South Yorkshire last April. The chairman of Doncaster's Safeguarding Children Board, Roger Thompson, promises improvements will be implemented.
The Safeguarding Board will be looking very actively to making sure that these recommendations are followed up and are properly audited, and that agencies are improving their services.
A teenager has been charged with the murder of 18-year-old schoolgirl Asha Munir. Her body was found on a riverside path in Reading on Monday night. 19-year-old Gulamir Akhtar will appear in court tomorrow. A mother's been jailed for more than 3 years for pretending her healthy son was severely ill so she could claim financial benefits. Exeter Crown Court heard Leah Hayden Johnson, who admitted child cruelty, subjected her son to 24-hour-a-day torture. Downing Street insists Gordon Brown welcomes the chance to give evidence to the Iraq inquiry. The Prime Minister's agreed to appear in front of the panel before the general election. No ministers were supposed to be called until afterwards. Political commentator John Rentoul says the timing of the inquiry has been a problem.
I think he's realised that he made a terrible mistake in having an inquiry that would have hearings in the run-up to a general election, reminding all those voters who care about the Iraq war how much they hate the Labour government.
McDonald's says it hopes to create 5,000 new jobs in the UK in 2010 after a record-breaking year here. The world's biggest burger chains posted global profits of £750 million. And Beyoncé is headlining London's leg of a series of shows to raise cash for Haiti later. Coldplay will also be on stage, as well as a group with Jay-Z. That's the latest. I'm Ben Biddulph.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Had a funny turn? Perhaps your speech was slurred or you couldn't pick up your cup of tea? You may well have had a mini stroke, also called a TIA. Mini strokes are an early warning sign. Spotting the signs of a mini stroke early and getting treatment can significantly reduce the risk of a full-blown stroke. Like a stroke, a mini stroke happens when the flow of blood to the brain is blocked by a small clot. But unlike a full stroke, with a mini stroke you'll often feel much better within a few hours. Don't ignore them. If you think you may have had a mini stroke in the past, talk to your GP. Strokes happen to people we care about. Act fast. Brought to you by NHS Bristol. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and our guest this week to discuss some of the big stories this week in Bristol, Britain and around the world is leader of the opposition Labour group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Our regular old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, Billy Quain will be along with his credit crunch beating What's On For Cheap This Weekend. Also, after six, we hear from some outspoken US veterans of the Iraq War and preview a controversial new feature film which premieres at the Sundance Film Festival in the US tomorrow, which looks at the comic side of suicide bombing. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Bristol's long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight. This weekend, averaging around about 5 degrees Celsius. A dry weekend with some sunny spells. Next week, again, around about 5 Celsius in the daytime. A dry but fairly cloudy week with some mist at the beginning of the week. Next weekend, that's the 30th and the 31st of January, averaging 5 degrees again in the daytime. A dry weekend with some sunny spells. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight or so from MetCheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news. And joining us this evening is Whitchurch Park councillor Helen Holland, who's also leader of the opposition Labour group on Bristol City Council. Welcome to Drive Time, Helen.
Hello, Tony.
And are you actually from Bristol yourself?
I'm not, and I've only been here. I came here in 1975, so that's, oh my goodness, now 35 years ago. So I hope that people have kind of got used to me. And my great proud boast is, of course, both of my children were born here, so they definitely are Bristolians.
And is it fair to say you're leader of the opposition? Because they're obviously, the Conservatives are also in opposition.
Well, I think we both say that we are.
Okay. What's your, this is just a sort of off the wall question, what's your favourite past or present political figure? Who are your political heroes?
Actually, I think some of my political heroes are the more unsung ones. I did some work looking back to, you know, early women councillors in Bristol. And Bristol, it took them quite a long time to get a woman elected after women were able to. And there was a fantastic woman, I've forgotten her, I wish she'd given me written notice of this question, Tony, but there was a fantastic woman, she was called Mabel something, I've forgotten what her second name was, but she was one of the very first councillors. And when you read some of the things that she had to put up with, you know, you just kind of realise how far we've come on. But
so are you as steely as she was?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Martin Summers is here too. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, I've got a little question for you. A spokesman for HSBC said this week that the star rating for government gilts or bonds is meaningless because governments always pay them back. So why do we need these private risk agencies giving these star ratings?
That's a very good question because, of course, these same agencies like Moody's and so on are the people that rated all of this toxic assets as AAA rating. And we're now saying that the British government's, or any government's, the Icelandic government's bonds are under threat, and that's why we've got to cut public expenditure. But it's the same ratings agencies that are deciding which countries are and are not viable.
So what effect do these, apparently, according to this HSBC chap, meaningless rating, what do they actually
have? What it means is that the British government is faced by what in the good old days used to be called a banker's ramp, which is if you don't do as we say, we're going to sell your bonds, and therefore you've got to cut public expenditure. As we go into the election campaign, I think this is going to be a key question because the Conservatives are keen to cut public expenditure. I would suggest that that is the wrong thing to do. That's not what they're doing in the United States of America, for example. And I think they need to go back and reread their general theory. That's not to say that we should just bail out banks willy-nilly. That's why we've got ourselves into this mess. We need to look at the whole system of finance and reform it properly, rather than just giving into scare tactics about spending more money than we've got. The United States is far more in the hole than Britain, but they're carrying on spending. So why can't we?
Helen, just to come back to you for a moment, one of the questions we have on here quite often, regularly, is that quite a lot of people in the city and councillors don't like the cabinet system that we have. We've had that for, I think, 3 or 4 years now. What are your thoughts? Because you've been in the cabinet most of that time, haven't you?
It's longer than 3 or 4 years. Actually, the law was changed, the legislation was changed in 2000. The Local Government Act meant that local authorities had to run either with a cabinet system or with an elected mayor system, which are, you know, the popular voices in Bristol that we don't want that either. So personally, I think the cabinet system is a very good one for the clarity of who's making the decisions, and that bit of it is very good. I think where it has perhaps failed, and we need to think more, and local authorities are doing, is that it sort of disenfranchises the other councillors if they don't feel that they've got a genuine role. And that can be people in the party of the cabinet as well, feel that, well, what am I here for, because it's only those 8 people who are making the decisions. So actually, I think the move towards neighbourhood partnerships that we introduced and the Lib Dems have continued with is one of those ways where actually the real difference, and councillors, even ones who've been on the council a long time, get a real buzz from representing their ward, and having much more stronger role within your own ward is one of the ways of influencing that.
Okay, now let's have a look at some of this week's stories. We start with, I suppose, the obvious one, really, which is Cadbury's and the question mark over the pledge to save the jobs in Keynsham. American food giant Kraft has renewed its pledge to save Keynsham's chocolate factory after agreeing an $11.5 billion takeover of Cadbury's. But the company's final offer, recommended by the directors, is missing a key statement by Kraft's chairman that previously put that promise in writing. MP Dan Norris, whose Wanstead constituency includes whose Summerdale plant hopes to meet with Kraft in the next few days to pin them down to a commitment on the 400 jobs remaining there. But isn't this a little bit late? Let's start with you, Helen.
Well, I was very much involved in the Keep Cadbury's and Keynsham campaign. Oh, it was the right thing. And actually, I don't think that the Cadbury's board are covered in glory over this whole issue. You know, there have been some crocodile tears from the Cadbury family about what's gone on. But in the end, the board, you know, was quite happy to sort of go to the highest bidder. And I think that I was listening to the radio the other day, and there was a worker there from Terry's in York who were also taken over by Kraft, and similar sorts of things. Yes, they said that they were going to keep Terry's in York, and after some years, that's now gone. So I'm very worried about it. I think that obviously they move Cadbury's production to Poland was one of the things that actually started undermining the Cadbury's name as a good employer in this part of the world, and I'm very concerned about it. And I hope to goodness that Dan Norris has a good conversation with Kraft, but let's face it, actually, governments can't influence this kind of thing.
But this isn't this attempting to shut the door after the horse's bolted?
Well,
because,
so.
I mean, what can he do now?
I don't think so, because a lot
of... The deal's been done, hasn't it?
Yes, and a lot of us were very much part of that campaign to try and get Cadbury's to invest in their own people. And if Cadbury's really felt that they had such a cachet as, you know, quality chocolate, etc., personally, I've been boycotting them ever since they said they were going to close Keynsham, so I can't comment on that. But, you know, if they were really serious about investing in their people, they would have kept, they would have held off from this bid from Kraft.
The irony is, of course, that the money for this takeover, much of it has come from, apparently 7 billion of it to finance the deal, has come from the Royal Bank of Scotland, which apparently is owned by the British taxpayer. So it seems like the British taxpayers, they're helping out Kraft. Martin, do you want to comment on this?
Well, I agree that as things stand, it's impossible for governments to influence these kind of decisions. But I think, you know, we're crying out for an overall industrial policy where government does create a framework where decisions like this are not just left to the market. I mean, I remember years ago when the first hostile takeover took place in Germany, the first one since the war, when Vodafone tried to take over Mannesmann in Germany, and the Germans were absolutely up in arms about it. And it's quite possible to run an economy without having a stock market driving the decisions. Lots of smaller countries do. We're just used to the idea that it's a free-for-all, and perhaps it shouldn't be.
So when the last factory in Britain is taken over by foreign investors and closed down, will the government then get their finger out and do something about this?
Well, I mean, if you look at France, they've been very much more concerned to keep French companies French than we have. We've had an open door policy for many years under Labour and Tory governments, and of course that's led to a situation where we don't really have an industrial policy, although we have one by the back door by having an arms industry.
Sounds to me, from what you're saying, Helen, that you're actually in favour of the free market in this case, even if it does mean that the decisions are made abroad about jobs here in Keynsham.
No, I think that you're right in the sense that, you know, could something have been done earlier, but very much earlier, about making the conditions right for Cadbury's.
But do you think it's something that government should actually be involved in, or do you think they should just let it ride?
I think I agree with Martin that actually having a policy that supports business being at, and obviously a lot of business has been supported, particularly over the last period whilst we've been in these difficult economic times. But I think that what we need is something that's very clear about decisions being taken locally,
But, I mean, surely the banks have been supported, haven't they? But not a lot of the ordinary employers.
Because everybody says about the banks have been supported, but the banks were bailed out, as you said earlier, in order to support the customers. That was what we couldn't have a situation where people's mortgages, savings all disappeared with the banks collapsing. So banks were supported in order to save people's savings, people's homes, people's mortgages. That's why it happened. And I think it's wrong to kind of paint it as it was the bankers who were helped out, although obviously the bankers and their bonuses caused a lot of grief. Actually, it was about supporting the economy and supporting people.
Do you think it makes any difference whether Cadbury's is run from Britain or the US?
Unfortunately, in this particular instance, I probably don't. And I know that some people think that there is more of a glimmer of hope that Somerdale will stay open with Craft in charge than it was with Cadbury's, where they'd already made the decision to go to Poland.
Well, let's hope that they do keep the jobs in Keynsham. But of course, if they do that, then the people in Poland will be disappointed, and we've got a kind of contest going on with the way in which international investment is regulated and managed. And we need to, rather than going at individual cases, I mean, this is all being done according to the existing setup. The question is that setup in the long term the right sort of setup to encourage, you know, a forward looking industrial economy, or are you just going to end up being a packaging plant for things that go on elsewhere? Obviously, with things like sweets, it's very much to do with the marketing and to do with the image. And as Helen pointed out, when Cadbury's decided to move out of Keynsham, they've actually undermined completely their image as a caring, responsible employer. And then that's the end of that, then, isn't it? So you're just another shark like the rest of them. So there's no real difference between you and Kraft, then.
Well, let's leave the final word to Felicity Loudon, who's the great-granddaughter of George Cadbury, reported in the Evening Post earlier this week, who, condemning the takeover, describing Kraft as a plastic cheese company and asset stripper. So let's just hope they don't strip the assets around here. Anyway, next story. Suspended coroner. The stress of investigation led to my heart attack. Now, this was on BBC Points West as well last night. The suspended Avon coroner, Paul Forrest, believes the stress he's suffered for the past 10 months sparked a heart attack. The man in charge of inquests for the region, who's been the subject of a judicial investigation since last March, was taken ill in September last year. Mr. Forrest is recovering at his home near Blagden, where he lives with his wife. Now, this sounds like a bit of a mess, really. Essentially, apparently, Mr. Forrest denies all allegations facing him, which have not been revealed in detail. The spokesman of the OJC, the Office for Judicial Complaints, which is looking into this case, in the light of further representations from Mr. Forrest, Lord Chief Justice and Lord Chancellor agree that an independent review body should be established to look into the case. I don't know if you have any insight into this, but how come the Avon coroner is being suspended, and we're now apparently paying, according to the BBC, something like £300,000 as the cost of suspending him because of all the other knock-on effects of it? It does seem that we can't survive really without a coroner, and the worry here is that he's been actually speaking out, apparently speaking to two people about his worries about the way the coroner service is running, and that he's been suspended as a result of speaking out. Now, that's not the right way to do things, surely. If he's speaking out about something, he shouldn't be suspended for it. He should be listened to.
Well, I don't know all of the details of who said what to whom and what state this is at, but clearly there is a coroner, because there's an interim coroner acting for us, and my understanding is that the figures that the BBC have got about how much this is all costing us, part of that relates to the cost of paying the coroner while he's suspended, plus paying the interim coroner. So it just sounds to me as if it's a real mess, and the sooner people can sort this out, so if it's been referred to a higher body, what we want is for them to report as quickly as possible so it can be sorted out.
Can you just explain one anomaly, and that is that we're hearing here about the Avon coroner. Now, I thought Avon had gone. I thought we were just Bristol, North Somerset, South Gloucestershire now.
Well, it has to all intents and purposes, but as you know, we've got the Avon and Somerset Police Force, so the name lives on, and of course we have the River Avon running through the area as well. So I think he's referred to as the Avon coroner because he still covers the former Avon area, or as some people call it, Cuba, the county that used to be Avon.
Okay. Now, one of the things which was a real problem with this whole business was the moving of the coroner's court from Bristol city centre, which is down near the bottom of Stokes Croft, out to Flaxbourton. Now, it must be very, very difficult for anyone that wants to get to an inquest from Bath to even find the coroner's court out in the middle of nowhere, and it's a tiny little building. And as I understand it, it was partly the facilities that the coroner has to look into suspicious deaths down in Flaxbourton that caused this whole furore in the first place. And the suspension of the coroner, because he's saying, look, there's not enough facilities there for me to do my job.
I mean, I can't comment, but I do think that you're right, that it seems a bit anomalous not to have a facility like that where any people from any of the four constituent authorities have got to access that service if it's, you know, certainly not accessible, I wouldn't have thought, very well by public transport. And, you know, if Bristol or even Bath, Weston-super-Mare, one of the more urbanised centres was the centre, that would have seemed to have made more sense.
I mean, the coroner's court down in Flaxbourton, actually, I've been past there, and it's out in the middle of nowhere. If you get a bus down to Flaxbourton, which is probably about once every 2 hours the buses go, you've then got to find a public footpath across the fields to actually get to the coroner's court. And this may be possibly having something to do with the reason why the coroner, Paul Forrest, is a bit disgruntled about it and why he was saying something. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Helen that it's, you know, particular cases like this where an individual's being supposedly disciplined and he's disputing it, I think it would be inappropriate to comment, because that's why we have independent tribunals and things to look into it. I don't know whether he's right or whether he's wrong. He should certainly get fair treatment, and if his allegations are correct, they should be dealt with.
Well, what they're saying,
if they're not, then they should be dismissed.
Well, what the BBC are saying is that apparently Mr. Forrest made inappropriate comments to two people after a dispute over how Flaxbourton Coroner's Court should be run.
Well, that's okay. So we've got a grievance in process, and therefore, you know, that should be left to run and dealt with properly.
Well, my concern is
he may be wrong.
If he's raising issues, then surely he should be listened to rather than put on suspension. Well, I mean, isn't this one of the problems in modern Britain? Is that the people are running too quickly to this recourse of suspending people and, you know, rather than listening to them.
Well, I agree that the balance is far too far in favour of employers. It has been for many, many years, and it probably needs to be redressed. And, you know, that. But I assume, as a lawyer and working in a legal situation, that this gentleman probably does know what he's talking about, perhaps. But then, of course, the other people will know what they're talking about. So it's inappropriate for us to try and second-guess that kind of investigation.
OK, well, let's wait and see how that one goes. Another story. Now, Gordon Brown backs plans to scrap the poll system. Gordon Brown yesterday threw his weight behind a plan to scrap the first past the post voting system. Instead, he favours an alternate vote in which MPs need more than 50% in the polls to be elected. Now, that's in the Daily Mirror today. Yesterday, sorry. Martin, can you throw a bit of light on this first past the post system, and what difference would it make if we were to change the voting system?
Well, the alternative vote system, which Gordon Brown seems to be backing, basically means you still have one candidate getting more than 50% of the vote, and the votes are redistributed around, but it's not a proportional system. So it's a move in the direction of a proportional system is what he's proposing. Personally, I'm in favour of a proportional system. I don't know what Helen's view is about this. I'm with Robin Cook on this. I think that we've become too varied a society to just have a ding-dong between two major parties. There's too many varied points of view. We need to have a more flexible political system, a bit like they have in Ireland or Denmark. That would be my view. And if Gordon Brown's stepping in that direction, I think that's quite wise, because the only people who don't want any kind of change in the voting system are the Conservatives.
Is that true?
Well, I've always been a first-past-the-post person, really. But I think one of the problems is that the cat is out of the bag, really, because the Scottish Parliament is elected on a proportional system, the Welsh one is, and you can't really have so many different systems running, because it's very confusing for the poor old electorate. That isn't to run anybody's, you know, understanding of the system down, but you do want things to be very transparent.
It's true to say, though, isn't it, that in the first-past-the-post system, lots and lots of the votes are effectively wasted.
Well,
you have to vote for the party that's going to win.
Yes.
It means that the smaller parties don't get a chance.
Less so the case. But I, you know, what is often floated is that very unrepresentative groups, if you look at Europe, for example, because of the proportionment of the votes, you can get extremist people who actually get a voice, whereas the first-past-the-post system does eliminate that.
Okay. You're talking about the BNP and parties like that?
If I can just jump in on that, I mean, one place in Britain where we do run a purse past the a proportional system is in Northern Ireland, and that is precisely to do what Helen is suggesting, to give extremists a voice within the system so that they stop fighting democracy and start playing with it. And I think we've got a lot of tensions coming up as the economic crisis bites. We've got to make sure that everybody out there, whoever they are, feels that they've got some stake in the system, whether they're a loyalist paramilitary or whoever it is. And that's why we brought proportional representation in Ireland. And I think the same argument holds for the UK as a whole.
Do you think it's fair to say that the Labour and Conservative parties are both wedded to the first-past-the-post system because they've done quite well out of it over the last 80 years?
I think, you know, as Martin says, there are some very high-profile proponents for proportional representation within the Labour Party. I'm not so, quite so sure within the Conservative Party. But I think it's interesting. I didn't pick this story up. I don't know whether it was very extensively covered yesterday. But, of course, a lot of people are saying that one of the outcomes of the general election could be a hung parliament, and that one of the things that a bargain between any parties might might be struck on is around electoral systems.
It seems very funny to be doing this after the election. I mean, if Gordon Brown really believed in the proportional representation, surely he'd be doing it before the election. Well, and anyway, can he bind the next government if it's not Labour is not included in the next government?
Of course not. But I suppose it's to air that debate. Although it's a bit late. Before the general election this year to bring in a new system. Clearly, whatever happens, it's going to be under the current system. But some people, again, will say that were there to be a hung parliament, there would be another general election quite soon afterwards, and that might be run under a different system. But personally, I still think that we'll have first past the post for some time yet.
I think we will have first past the post for the reasons you've just explained, which is that that it's too late to change the horse now for the next general election. But I think I welcome this statement because it shows that the Labour Party is open to thinking about it. And as Helen's pointed out, we've already got a proportional system in other parts of the country, and the sky hasn't fallen down. In actual fact, you see in the Scottish Parliament, the SNP struggling to form a majority with the Liberals, the Labour and the Tories all combining to prevent them getting what they want. And this is normal politics in the rest of Europe. That consent, it means deals, it means but what it also means is that people can vote for what they really believe in and know that their vote will be counted and will count towards the outcome. And I think that's very important. It was very important in Ireland for obvious reasons. Everybody had to feel that they had somebody at that table that was going to be listened to, and therefore they were all committed to the process.
Can I just say something about the local situation here? Because you might be aware, a couple of months ago we took a motion to the City Council to say that Bristol actually ought to have all-out elections once every 4 years, rather than the out-by-third system that we have.
It's pretty complicated, isn't it?
It's very complicated. And one of the arguments, unfortunately, the motion wasn't carried, but one of the arguments that was put against that was that actually it wouldn't mean that there was necessarily a clear administration for 4 years. But I think that slightly missed the point, because I very much agree with what Martin's just said about what has happened and what happens in most of the rest of Europe, is that there does have to be this bargaining after elections in order to get a stable administration. And if you look at certainly two of our surrounding authorities in Bath and North East Somerset and South Gloucestershire, neither of those Tory administrations are majority ones, but they had to have that more mature conversation, which somehow we don't seem to have been able to have had in Bristol. And so it's been this kind of what I describe as the hokey-cokey, kind of in-out Labour, Lib Dem, who's going to work with who.
We had quite a long period of time with no administration, didn't we? Because Labour and Liberal were arguing over whether who would actually take on the various important posts and committees and things.
It was actually all three parties were unable to come to a deal. That was after the elections in 2003. And I think we've moved on from that, and we have had minority administrations that have been able to work. But what I'm saying is that if you did have an all-out system in Bristol and people knew that you were talking about coming to an agreement that's got to last 4 years, that's different from what we've had at the moment, which has sometimes resulted in administrations who've only lasted, less than a year.
And presumably people can hang on in the hopes that the next partial election will rescue them and what have you. And also for the electorate, they need to know this is going to be decided here.
Yes,
and that it encourages turnout.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like going to a cup final. You know, we're going to decide who runs Bristol. Whereas we know when you have the third, you know, staggered elections, it's not quite clear why people are turning out.
So what exactly is the system, Helen? Is it over 4 years or what?
It's incredibly complicated, but I'll do my best to explain it simply. It's over 4 years, but it's a system by thirds. So for a start, there's 1 year when there are no elections.
Is that this year?
No.
Well, we have got elections.
2008.
We've got local elections this year,
so
then.
We've got a local election.
Probably the same time as the general election.
Yeah, hopefully. Yep. And in what that will mean is that a third of the seats are up, but that isn't the same as a third of the wards. This is why it's so complicated. If you look at it as kind of three plates that are rotating around Bristol, because actually, even though there's an election in one ward and not one next door, that doesn't mean that next year it'll be next door's turn and not ours. You know, it is very complicated. And I absolutely agree with Martin, because A, people can't get their heads around it. Why is it that, you know, we've got a vote in Southville, but my friend over in another part of the city hasn't? That's one question. And the other is, people think, well, there they go again, you know, it'll be another lot who just hang on for a few months and then somebody else will come along and we'll have the chance again. And it just doesn't have the clarity about who ends up running Bristol.
How did we end up with a system like that in Bristol? Is it a general system that's running the country as a whole, or was it Bristol decided to run it like that itself?
Well, my understanding is that there was a discussion about it when Bristol became city and county, when Avon, second time it's come up in the interview this afternoon, when that disappeared. And there are other major cities that also run the system by thirds, but I think that so many of the issues, the big strategic issues where you've got to work with your neighbours, you need to give people a 4-year window, if you like, to actually do things and then be judged, rather than everything stopping just after Christmas because people have got an eye on what's going to happen in May and we better not do anything unpopular.
Doesn't it mean that we do get a little bit more of politicians actually listening to the public because it's happening more regularly, the election's happening more regularly?
I think that if that were true, I would support it. But I think what actually happens is that people, rather than politicians, as well as listening, also have to lead and set a vision. And if they don't do that because, you know, they get 300 emails from a disgruntled group who don't like the plans for whatever it is at the moment, then it seems to me that that kind of prevents that. Set a vision, say what you're going to do, and then at the end of the period being judged on it.
Okay, next story. Muslim police say that Islam is not to blame for terror attacks. This is in the Daily Telegraph yesterday. Muslim police officers have rebelled openly against the government's anti-terror strategy, warning that it's an affront to British values, which threatens to trigger ethnic unrest. The National Association of Muslim Police, NAMP, claimed that ministers were wrong to blame Islam for being the driver behind recent terrorist attacks. Far-right extremists were much more dangerous threat to national security, it said. The officers told MPs that Muslims were being stigmatised by the government's attempts to tackle terrorism, which was adding to hatred against entire communities. In the official intervention, the association said the government's anti-terrorism policies could not continue unchecked. Right, Martin, yes, let you start on this. Is this a surprise to see that Muslims within the police association of Muslim police officers is coming out and saying actually that Islam is not to blame for the terror attacks?
Well, patently, Islam as such is not to blame for terror attacks, and that's a perfectly straightforward point to be made, isn't it? If you remember, Tony, when we went to speak at Birmingham Central Mosque last July, there was a plainclothes police officer in the audience, Muslim police officer, and he said, what annoys me is people keep talking about Britain being a police state. I said, it's not a police state, I'm a policeman, but we've got less and less power, and there's more and more power in the hands of the security services, who are not answerable, who are not accountable.
So this is MI5 and Special Branch?
And so on, yes. And I think that people have got to have confidence in the local police, whoever, whatever community they come from. Religions are not responsible for terrorism. Terrorists are, whoever they may be. And they need to be prosecuted and dealt with through intelligence gathering by a police force that's trusted by the local community. And we've seen a whole process of the reform of the police service in Northern Ireland to make it acceptable to all sections of the community so that everybody can stand up with hand on heart and say it's the duty of all citizens to support the police force. But that means the accountable local police force, not unaccountable secret service type people, because there's a very strong suspicion in the Muslim community, and not only in the Muslim community, that elements of the state are not to be trusted on these matters. And I'm afraid there's a lot of evidence to suggest that from Ireland and elsewhere.
But don't you think maybe the Muslim police officers are in denial here, because the failed Detroit bombing on Christmas Day was carried out apparently by an Al-Qaeda inspired extremist who studied in London?
We've been told a story about that, which we're still, everybody's looking into. He's actually been arrested by the FBI, and all the heads of Homeland Security, CIA, all of it were at a Senate hearing yesterday, and they were all furious that this guy had been handed over to the FBI to be prosecuted properly. They said they should have been handed over to the CIA for torture and what have you. But I'm glad to say that the Obama administration has given that short shift. He's been taken by the FBI. He's going to be charged as a criminal. And of course, the question is, who did put him up to it? And there is a very strong suspicion, if we look back to the 1980s, the extremist Muslim groups in this country, like Al-Mujahideen, were being used by the security services, by MI6, to recruit British boys to fight in Afghanistan in the 80s, in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 90s. I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 90s. It was common knowledge that that was what was going on. So there's a very strong suspicion in the respectable Muslim community that Islamic extremist groups are a front for the intelligence services. Now, the simple way to deal with that is we put the hands of investigations in the hands of the accountable police force. That's what we've said in Ireland, that's what we should say in Britain as a whole.
Helen, the National Association of Muslim Police, do you think they have a right to come out and say that the government's policy is actually counterproductive and that is wrongfully stigmatising Muslims?
Of course they have a right to say it, because we live in a free country, and I'm glad that they are saying it, because I think that what we heard in the recent incident where the extremist Muslim group were going to march through Wootton Bassett, what you actually saw, both in Bristol and nationally, was British Muslims being very, very angered by those proposals, which actually, as Martin says, kind of stigmatise the rest of the Muslim population. And I thought there were some very, very clear statements by Muslims about extremist Muslim groups. And I think, you know, I'm glad in the sense that the police say it, the Muslim Association of Police say it, because you know, you can then have that debate.
Okay, next story. 19 Minutes of Horror, the Edlington assault. Now, of course, this has been all over the news the last couple of days. The two brothers sentenced yesterday for last year's Edlington assault had rehearsed their crime a week earlier, apparently, on March the 28th last year, luring a 12-year-old to a secluded spot by promising to show him a toad. Their vicious attack was interrupted by a passing fisherman. Now, there are parallels here with possibly with the Bulger case years ago, but the idea of 10 and 11-year-olds committing such heinous crimes. Martin, do you want to start on this one? Should they be... is there anything we can do about this? Do you think social services should have intervened? Or, I mean, should we just be resourcing social services better?
Well, again, it's hard to comment on individual cases unless you know exactly what's been going on.
Well, this has been very well discussed, this, and it does look like these two young men were on the radar. Very much so, local social services radar.
I think, you know, I'm loath to criticise unless I've got enough information to make a serious comment, but I will say this. I mean, after the case, the baby P, I think a woman Labour MP whose name I've forgotten spoke in the House of Commons, and she made a very pertinent point. She said that there are 250 children in this country every year murdered by their carers. Of those 250, only 60 are known to social services. So the vast majority of murders of small children by carers are not are not visible until the actual act takes place. We've clearly got a big problem there. There's all sorts of social reasons why that might be happening. But I think as a society as a whole, we have to think about what we do with children, how we treat children. And I think also in relation to these lads, I remember doing some pretty nasty things when I was their age, and it could easily have gone wrong, you know, throwing bricks at people and so on to try and intimidate them. And you can hurt people, can't you? And this doesn't sound like that. But I think, you know, we've got to take a step back. These children are themselves damaged and hurt people. And I, as I say, that's why we have a court system and all the rest of it, to look into it properly rather than me just pontificating.
Given that these two were on the radar of the local social services in Doncaster, is there anything we can do as a society to stop this thing happening?
Well, I think that is the point, that obviously they're two very damaged young boys, but that does not justify the horrific attack that they carried out on the other two children. And I think the important point about this case, and what's been said very clearly over the last few days, is that the court said that this incident, horrific incident, was preventable. And all local authorities, particularly after Victoria Climbier and the Baby Peter case, have had to check their safeguarding processes. And if agencies were aware of these two boys and didn't intervene to give them the help that they obviously needed, or to, you know, report to another agency or whatever, rather than passing the buck, it seems as if they didn't take action on people who were on the radar. I agree with Martin that some people aren't on the radar, and you cannot legislate for that. You know, there will always be incidents that come completely out of the blue. But it seems that this one, if the courts are saying it was preventable, then obviously all local authorities need to look very carefully at their own processes. And if I can tell you that in Bristol, what we did when the Baby Peter case came to the fore was that we examined, my former colleague, our deputy, then Peter Hammond, had this brief, and he instituted an investigation into what the Bristol systems were, to be reported back to a cross-party meeting, so that all parties, all elected members, all councillors, you know, they do want to know that you've got the right systems in place in your city. That, unfortunately, is not to say that we can say it would never happen in Bristol, because, as I say, there will always be cases. But when you hear about the suffering that these two boys went through, you have got to say, you've got to do absolutely everything you possibly can to make sure the agencies are working together, that they don't just, you know, file cases and not get on with them. You've got to know that there's action plans.
You do feel like tearing your hair out sometimes, though, because there was another case in the Daily Mail today of a child that was taken away from its mother at birth, apparently because she was not intelligent enough to bring it up. And when you can see children like that being taken away, and yet these two here, no intervention being made there at all, you do wonder if some of these social services in some parts of the country, hopefully not here, but in some parts of the country, really aren't accountable enough and aren't open enough about what they're doing.
You shouldn't just beat up social services. They do a very, very difficult job. If you take kids away, people complain. If you leave them there and they get injured, people complain. You know that the head of social services is in Hackney, is suing the government about the way she was treated in the Haringey. I think what we all need to do is take a step back and take responsibility for the very poor conditions under which some young people are growing up in this country.
Well, I know a lot of lawyers have actually been speaking out about the family court system and saying it's just far too secret, and there's too much discretion given to social workers as to which cases they intervene in and which cases they don't intervene in. There needs to be a little bit more openness, and that it's this culture of secrecy which is actually making some of these leading to some of these wrong decisions. There was a big thing in the Times, it's about 2 months actually ago, by lawyers saying that the family court system is possibly part of the problem. Anyway, let's move on to Tories' elitist view of teaching. Now, this came out from the Press Association Monday this week. The pre-election campaigning is raging on, with Gordon Brown setting out new plans to encourage social mobility, whilst David Cameron promised Conservatives would boost schools by restoring the prestige of the teaching profession. Mr. Cameron said the Tories would take a brazenly elitist approach to the school system, barring anyone without a 2-2 degree or better from teaching. Now, is this a good idea or not? So do you want to start, Helen? You're shaking your head.
I am shaking my head. I'm a former teacher. And I just think that we all know teachers who were fantastic. You know, when we were growing up, I'm sure everybody's got teachers that they can remember in their school days. I don't know whether they'd passed their O-level or whatever it was at the time. But I think to actually set a bar in that way, and obviously Cameron is trying to be provocative by talking about being brazenly elitist. I suppose it's kind of tongue-in-cheek about it. Of course you want the teachers to be competent, but as we all know, there are many people who are very good teachers who actually take teaching as a second career after doing something very successfully out in the, you know, real world, if you want me to call it that, but and then go into teaching. Are we really saying that they should be disbarred and put off from going into teaching, which is, you know, it's a tough job, and good teachers are so important as role models for the kids that they teach? And I think that this is a piece of Conservative nonsense.
Martin?
Well, I have to agree with that. Obviously, my father was a head teacher in inner city Liverpool for many years. I mean, it just shows how out of touch they are with what goes on in state schools, frankly. I mean, the real problem isn't that we're not getting too much Oxbridge entry, it's that some kids are slipping through the net altogether, that their schools don't offer anything which offers them a way to make sense of their lives. And a lot of teachers that are working at the sharp end in inner cities just find all of this stuff ridiculous. I remember when we've had Conservatives on this programme saying, well, that we need to have more streaming in state schools. And you feel like, well, we've had streaming in state schools since 1962 or whatever, and it just shows how distant they are from the problems.
Do you think we'll be able to actually persuade? Do you think Mr Cameron will be able to twist the arms of all these graduates, the top-level graduates?
They can't get enough people to do teaching in inner-city schools as it is. I mean, why raise the bar?
I mean, students are incentivised because of the shortage of teachers, particularly in maths and sciences, are incentivised to go and do their postgraduate teaching certificate as it is. You know, it seems as if David Cameron is almost kind of unaware of what actually is going on in order to try and attract good people into the teaching profession. But I would still contend that you don't necessarily have to be a graduate in order to end up being an excellent role model.
But don't you think really what he's saying here is that he wants more prestige to be associated with teaching, and that he feels that it's slipped down the agenda?
Yes, but that's his idea of prestige. You've got to have a 2-2, otherwise you're nothing. I mean, that's the world they live in, isn't it?
Okay, now we're going to move on now to Marina Morris, and she's been out on the streets of Bristol having a chat to people about what they think of some of the proposals which have been mooted in Scotland and are being apparently brought in Scotland to limit the offers of alcohol in supermarkets. What do the people of Bristol think about possible ways to control people's behaviour on Friday nights and Saturday nights?
The Scottish Health Secretary is recommending minimum pricing to cut the burden of Scotland's drink problems. Should this policy be adopted throughout the UK?
Personally, I've seen many, many people who can consume alcohol and many other products in a reasonable and responsible manner. I think purely recognising the consumption of a product as the main source for a individual or society as a whole's desired behaviour patterns would once again be flawed.
Well, I think it would make sense maybe to first test it in one particular area. Why not Scotland? And if it's successful, then maybe extend it throughout the UK.
I think it's hard to tell. Because I think if people are going to get alcohol, they're going to pay more anyway. So the only effect of minimum pricing would be more tax money. I don't think it'll help a great deal. No.
No, I don't believe so, because at the end of the day, I think it actually infringes on freedom of, well, human freedom, really. I mean, people should have their own right to drink responsibly without the government telling them what they should and shouldn't be doing.
How much of a problem is drink in Bristol?
The majority of people who enjoy a good night out in Bristol do so in a responsible manner and are courteous to those around them. Of course, things get a little bit rowdy, people enjoy themselves, emotions are high. It's part of lesson of steam. We have a good police force in place who assist people should they find themselves in difficulty. I don't perceive it and recognise it to be much of a problem. There isn't a great deal of street drinking that takes place, and when it does take place, it seems to take place in a controlled manner. Unfortunately, we still do have a little bit of a problem with the amount of litter that is created on a weekend. Sometimes it appears that we do not have the correct facilities for the general public to sensibly dispose of the litter they generate. But at the same time, some people, unfortunately, are still disposing their litter in a very irresponsible manner.
Well, I'm not actually from Bristol, from Chester originally, but I live in Russia at the moment, and I certainly have a problem with drink there.
I think it's becoming a major problem, certainly since the licensing laws were relaxed, must be about 15 years ago now. There has been a lot more trouble with alcohol. Well, I might be unpopular, but I'd say bring back some of the licensing laws. It is a problem in certain areas. Well, there have been several areas which have been declared no drinking areas, and so obviously there were problems there for it to be declared in the first place.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's too bad. I mean, I've been to many other cities up north, and Bristol's quite quiet and quite reserved compared to a lot of places. I mean, Bristol is just quite a mild city, so I think all the things in the papers lately vilifying Bristol drinking is actually quite over the top.
Terrible. It's out of hand. Got out of hand, I think.
What should we expect from local authorities?
Taking steps and measures to remove knee-jerk policy-making.
It's very hard to say because there's only so much that you can do by introducing different rules and regulations, and ultimately it's more of a cultural problem than any problem connected to different means or official means of clamping down on something. It's all bound up with the economy, with class, with a lot of other social problems. I don't know, maybe there has been a positive change in lifestyles over the last few decades with to some extent, the gentrification of different regions, of different areas, maybe with maybe to some extent the decline of traditional pubs. In some ways, maybe it's actually a good thing, because it does the sort of people who go to wine bars, for instance, are less likely to be abusing alcohol than if they're going to pubs all the time. But this is only a very, very small part of the problem, and I think the main thing is that people should have opportunities to lead a fulfilling life, to have work, and to respect themselves. And in that case, they're less likely to indulge in abusive behaviour with alcohol or drugs or other antisocial behaviour.
Local authorities have got to be very careful the way they when they grant the licences, which I know they are being, but I think they're tied by the law at the moment. If the law allows 24-hour licences, people are going to apply for it.
Personally, I think they should leave it alone. I mean, if they want to put on more warnings about the effects for the youth and whatnot, then that's fair enough. But ultimately, I think it does infringe on human rights to get too involved with it. People should have their own responsibility.
Well, I'm not entirely surprised to hear Bristolians saying that it's an issue of human rights over their right to buy cheap alcohol. But, Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Is there any point in trying to stop supermarkets selling cheap alcohol?
Well, we have tax on alcohol anyway, don't we? It's normal. The reason we tax alcohol is because it's a bad. So we don't want to say you can't do it, but we don't want to encourage people to overdo it, and that's why we put taxes on. So it's actually a matter of judgment what that level of tax should be to make the price as high as we want it to be. You don't want smuggling where people, because the taxes on it is so high, that people are basically making hooch at home. But on the other hand, you don't want to encourage people to go out and drink. That's why we put the price at the level we put it. Actual pint of beer is only worth about 2p, but we don't charge 2p, do we?
I think from my understanding, this has come from something that the Chief Medical Officer has said about being in favour of a minimum price for a unit of drink. And I think one of the problems about the city centre, or any city centre, this isn't unique to Bristol, is that a lot of young people can go and buy a lot of very cheap drink in the supermarket and are already well on the way before they then go into the city centre. And we know that many of the supermarkets sell drink as a loss leader. Actually, they're not making any money on it. It's one of the things that they're selling cheap in order to get people in through the door. And you do have to recognise that some, first of all, I think it makes young people very vulnerable to be in a state where they completely are, or any people, it isn't only young people, is it, who this affects, but where, you know, you don't even know what's happening to you. People are very vulnerable, and also the health problems of it, which, as Martin said, the tax on alcohol, in the same way as on cigarettes, is designed to balance, if you like, the expense to the National Health Service of illnesses that come from overindulging.
Well, do you think it's true, one of the people said there, that people get drunk because they want to escape? They've got other problems in their lives and that they turn to alcohol.
Well, that's always been the case about any drugs of choice, of which alcohol is one, I guess, isn't it?
Martin?
Well, I mean, obviously social stress shows up as things like abuse of alcohol. There's a very interesting book by a guy, I've forgotten the name of the professor, he's written, it's called The Spirit Level, and he shows that more equal societies have less social problems, including alcohol abuse, than more unequal societies. And it actually doesn't even matter what level of income you're on. More equal societies have better social statistics. I think it's been very influential on some cabinet ministers' thinkings, this book. I can't remember the name of the chap who wrote it, but it's called The Spirit Level. If you look it up on the internet, you'll see what the book is. There's some very convincing graphs in there showing that the more equal a society is, like Japan or Iceland, the less problems they have with things like alcoholism and so on. And it's overwhelming. It's not even disputable.
Okay, let's move on to another story that you've brought in, Helen. This is also from the Evening Post, yesterday's Evening Post. Eco-fuel is vital for the biomass power plants. Now, obviously, everyone's thinking about how we're going to be supplying our energy needs in the next 20, 30 years, and particularly whether we really need a new nuclear power station at Hinkley and Oldbury. Can you just tell us what this story's all about?
Well, this was a motion that was debated in Council on Tuesday, which says that, you know, Bristol has aspirations to be a green city, and biomass fuel generation is, on the face of it, a green technology, but not if you're sourcing the fuel from the other side of the world and from an area where it may be being grown, where actually if there's been deforestation, or if food crops could have been grown on that for the indigenous people in that area. So I think that this was saying, as a matter of policy, that we would always try, wherever possible, to make sure that the fuel that drives these plants is from a sustainable.
But I mean, if it's coming from,
and this has to go alongside a whole range of other moves towards having better sources of renewable energy, like the turbines that you see down at Avonmouth when you go past now on the motorway, which is a great site and is providing lots of power already in the city.
But if we are going to be generating fuel from biomass, it's going to be being grown somewhere else in the world, and surely replacing another crop which could be of use to the people who live there, whoever it is. The only positive sort of thing I can see that you might want to import is coal, because that's not really necessarily of much use. It's under the ground somewhere. I mean, what they're saying essentially is a similar argument which is being used with biofuels, biodiesel, which is, this is really a bad thing to do, because in the country where this fuel is coming from, all this biomass, it's actually taking over land which could be being used to grow food and other products for the local people.
Well, that's exactly what this motion said, that where we are using biofuels, that they should have they need to come from sustainable sources.
So we've got a lot of coal still under the ground in South Wales.
Yes, and the government is putting quite a lot of money into research about clean coal plants, which wouldn't be like the old coal-fueled power stations. But what we know is that the call on energy is forever greater. And, you know, what are the figures in China that they open a new coal-fired power station one a week, I think it is, or something, in that country?
Right, Martin, you get one sentence on this.
I quite agree that we shouldn't be using fuel from the wrong sources. I was on a delegation to Colombia, a trade union delegation, 4 years ago, and one of the things that's happening there is that right-wing paramilitaries are massacring peasants, driving them off the land, and once they've gone, it's turned into a fuel oil plantation, palm oil plantation. And we need to be thinking local for solutions to energy, and most of all, we need to be saving it so that we don't have to generate as much.
Well, it's nearly time for the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to Helen Holland, ex-leader of Bristol City Council and currently leader of the Labour Group, opposition group. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, Bristol Respects Party's Joe Benefield will be here helping us to review the news. Stay with us if you can, though, because Credit Crunch beater Billy Quain is here after the 6 o'clock news with his guide to what's on that won't break the bank around town this weekend. Also in the next hour, thousands of US soldiers have returned to the United States and are speaking out after their tours of duty in Iraq. They've formed a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War, and we'll be hearing what they have to say. Also, a controversial new film which shows the comic side, if you can believe it, to suicide bombers. We'll be back after the news.